This Writer Centre Norwich podcast was recorded at the 2015 World's Literature Festival and features a provocation by the novelist, biographer and broadcaster Chris Bixby.
Last month, Sepp Blatter offered himself for re-election so that he could, in his words, restore the reputation of FIFA, which is a reminder that writers don't have a monopoly on irony. I'd like to begin with a definition of the word. According to the Collins Dictionary definition, reputation is an estimation in which a person is generally held. It points out, though, that that may mean either estimable or notorious, helpfully glossing the latter as especially a reputation for promiscuity, excessive drinking, or the like. Of course, since we're here thinking of writers, we know it's possible to keep those two ideas in the mind at the same time without ceasing to function. What's odd about these dictionaries, though, is that their usage examples tend to be negative. Hence, the first Oxford English Dictionary usage example is, his reputation was tarnished by allegations of bribery. That's the first usage of reputation. More than that, they have a fascination with writers and not necessarily a positive one. The Collins Dictionary offers the following usage example of the word repute, a writer of little repute. For reputed, it suggests he's the reputed author of two epic poems. Balancing that, though, the Macmillan Dictionary offers his novel won the Booker Prize and established his reputation. Nor do universities escape. Macmillan's second usage example is Albertson will stop at nothing to safeguard the reputation of the university. So there you have it. Writers are suspect and only establish their reputations by winning the Booker, while academics are shameless in promoting their university. I was flying back from the United States once and the captain came on and apparently he said on board was a high school twirling team with the highest reputation in the country. Half the passengers broke into applause and the other half sat bemused thinking, what the fuck is twirling? It was a reminder that reputation may not simply be time-bound. Next year's twirlers twirling a mite faster or anti-clockwise, but limited to particular communities. As Dante observed in the Inferno, the reputation which the world bestows is like the wind that shifts now here, now there. Reputations can be remarkably local, and those of us in the literary world can often make the mistake of thinking that writers' reputations are widely known. Samuel Beckett means nothing to most of the world's population. While Wayne Rooney, who once signed autographs in a brothel while waiting to have sex with a grandmother dressed in a rubber catsuit, and then successfully sued the News of the World for damaging his reputation, has a five-book, £5 million deal with HarperCollins and would be recognised around the world. Reputations, of course, can be constructed as well as earned. The public relations industry was born at the beginning of the 20th century in an effort to restore the reputations of the robber barons, the clue being in the name, and in particular of John D. Rockefeller. Ivy Lee, the founder of the industry, and who Upton Sinclair called Poison Ivy, was hired by Rockefeller and Standard Oil to burnish the family image. He also went to work for the German company IG Farben, with which Standard Oil had a close and rather notorious relationship. Today, though, Rockefeller means the Rockefeller Foundation, while the anti-Semitic Henry Ford, publisher of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and whose photograph Hitler kept in his private office, is now known through a foundation which distributes money to writers, even if in doing so in the 1950s and 60s, it was acting as a covert agent of the CIA in its conspiracy to corrupt the cultural life of friendly countries. Encounter magazine, of course, was their creature, but somehow its reputation has survived its own history. Today, there's an organization called the Reputation Institute, whose central project is called the Global Reputational Pulse, based on what it calls reputation-based metrics. And I hope to God the university never discovers this, or we'll all be required to take our reputational pulses. Amber Melville Brown is today a partner of Withers Worldwide, a company committed, in her words, to the restoration of reputation. Hers is a profession called reputation management. She quotes Warren Buffett as remarking that it takes 20 years to build a reputation and 5 minutes to ruin it, something Hugh Grant learned on Sunset Boulevard. Her job, she has explained, is to seek to educate clients in how not to ruin their hard-earned good reputation, to dispel unfairly earned bad reputations, and to act swiftly to mitigate any damage caused by 5 minutes of foolishness. The 5 minutes of foolishness which sometimes makes life worth living. The Levinson inquiry wasn't simply about phone hacking, it was about citizens' right to protect their reputations. Ironically, his appearance before the inquiry helped to restore Hugh Grant's reputation, as his blows directed at the News of the World eclipsed memories of the blowjob on Sunset Boulevard. Sometimes the restoration of reputation can indeed seem to smack of the miraculous. 4,000 people, five American presidents, and a host of world leaders attended the funeral of a man whose reputation had earlier been shredded. This, after all, was the man of whom Johnny Carson once remarked, "I hear that whenever someone in the White House tells a lie, Nixon gets a royalty." While President Harry Truman remarked that he was a no-good lying bastard, adding that he can lie out of both sides of his mouth at the same time, and even if he caught himself telling the truth, he'd lie just to keep his hand in. As Nixon was to say later of his involvement in the Watergate scandal, "I was not lying. I said things that later on seemed to be untrue." As Hamlet says, "Seems I know not, seems." Yet there he was, his reputation burnished by death, as some writers are, preparing, one presumes, to lie his way into heaven. Just for balance, how did Bill Clinton lie to the American public? "I did not have sexual relations with that woman," and go on to have a reputation as a moral force in the world, though like Tony Blair, subverting it by charging $250,000 for delivering a speech before restoring it by creating, guess what, a foundation. Marlon Brando once observed that fame thrives in the manure of success. Fame, however, like celebrity, is not reputation. The process goes in descending order: reputation, fame, celebrity, notoriety, infamy. In America, though, that process can be reverse. How else account for Henry Kissinger? The fact is that there may be, and often is, a gap between reputation and identity. I give you Jay Gatsby and Don Draper from Mad Men. There may also be a gap between a writer's view of him or herself and their public reputation. Doris Lessing deeply resented being appropriated as a feminist icon on the basis of what she insisted was a misreading of the Golden Notebook. In the New York Times of October the 2nd, 1891, an article appeared which began, "There has died and been buried in this city during the current week, at an advanced age, a man who is so little known even by name to the generations now in the vigor of life that only one newspaper contained an obituary account of him, and this was but of 3 or 4 lines." A year earlier, the New York Publishers Weekly printed an article which declared, "There are more people today who believe Herman Melville dead than there are know he is living." 44 years ago, it carries on, when his most famous tale, Typee, appeared, "There was no better known author than he. Talk about literary fame, there's a sample of it." Why did his reputation collapse? Why had he been extinguished from the national mind? In large part, it was the publication of Moby Dick, which the Charleston Southern Quarterly Review greeted as dull, dreary, and ridiculous. Captain Ahab was apparently a monstrous bore whose ravings, like that of his creator, would justify Melville being issued with a writ de lunicato. The New York United States Magazine and Review declared, "The truth is, Mr. Melville has survived his reputation." 5 years before William Faulkner won the Nobel Prize, only one of his 17 novels was in print. That is deliberately sensationalist Sanctuary, in which a woman is raped with a corn cob. F. Scott Fitzgerald, whose reputation could hardly have been higher following The Flawed, This Side of Paradise, and The Beautiful and Damned, then published The Great Gatsby, which H.L. Mencken greeted as no more than a glorified anecdote and not not too probable at that. Ruth Snyder in the New York Evening World observed, "We are quite convinced after reading The Great Gatsby that Mr. Fitzgerald is not one of the great American writers today." Swopes World declared, "F. Scott Fitzgerald's latest, a dud." The New York Times greeted Tender as the Night as not the work of a wise and mature novelist. There were some good reviews. He continued to sell, but like Melville, had moved away from the work that had forged his reputation, only for his reputation subsequently, once revived, to rest almost entirely on the work partly dismissed, or in Melville's case regarded as evidence of his lunacy. In 1965, a novel was published which had reasonable reviews, but then went out of print, having sold 2,000 copies. When its author died, the New York Times obituary headed novelist, editor, and professor of English, and that 1965 novel received nothing more than a name check. 50 years on, it became a bestseller. The author was John Williams, the book Stoner. It was republished with an introduction by John McGaughan. That was 2003. In the next 9 years, though, it sold fewer than 5,000 copies and became a print-on-demand book. By the end of the following year, though, sales were heading towards 200,000. The French had already responded. They were followed by the Dutch, the Italians, the Germans, the Israelis. Rights were sold into 24 countries. British writers lined up to praise it. Julian Barnes, while confessing he'd never previously heard of Williams, and Ian McEwan, among others. In America, though, there was very little evidence of interest. His name had no resonance. A 2013 article in The New Yorker called Stoner the greatest American novel you've never heard of, the same year that in this country Waterstones made it their book of the year, incidentally beating Julian Barnes's own Levels of Life. Greater love have no man than this, he laid down his own book for another. Stoner was an example of what's been called Lazarus literature. Now, it's tempting to think how smart we are and how stupid and uncomprehending were those who dismissed Melville and others. We, of course, would have been the one person who bought the only painting sold by Vincent van Gogh in his lifetime. We would have recognised Manet's earlier works as others did not. We would not have rioted on the first night of The Rite of Spring or hissed at the end of the first act of Chekhov's The Seagull. We would have embraced the birthday party in an almost empty theatre. Even Peter Hall, who directed the first production of Waiting for Godot, has confessed that it was only after a month of rehearsals that he recognised its greatness. The Beckett of whom the critic Bernard Levin remarked, "Mr. Samuel Beckett has produced a remarkable piece of twaddle." For every Lazarus writer, though, there were many who failed to claw their way out of the grave. There was a time when Christopher Fry's verse dramas were seen as avant-garde. His reputation was high, but his career effectively died in 1956 when the English theatre belatedly discovered naturalism. Now, you'll all be flipping through your mental Rolodexes of writers once regarded as central who drifted away, their reputations eclipsed. Here, a particularly painful case is that of Angus Wilson, a founder professor of UEA and knighted for services to literature. David Taylor, over there, wrote a piece in The Guardian, which a sub-editor, I presume, headed Angus Wilson from Darling to Dodo, or was that yours? Right. David suggests that Wilson suffered on the one hand because in the 60s he got out of touch with the society he'd so accurately captured in his earlier novels, and on the other hand was seduced without fully understanding by the new mood of experimentalism, then being promoted in universities, if not in the bookstores. Yet, as Ian McEwan has observed, art is a conversation conducted down through the generations. In a living artistic tradition, the dead never quite lie down. It was Marcus Aurelius who said that everything that exists is in a manner the seed of that which will be. Is there such a thing of which it is said, "See, this is new"? It has already been in the ages before us. Wilson left the country for France, where he was appreciated, or believed he was. And an interesting phenomenon is the differing reputations of writers at home and abroad. George Eliot in Felix Holt may have a character speak of abroad, that large home of ruined reputations. But there are many writers and performers who flourished abroad while being largely ignored at home. William Faulkner was embraced by the French. Though the French are surely strange when it comes to popular culture, showing a bizarre admiration for Jerry Lewis and Mickey Rourke. The British comedian and actor Norman Wisdom, largely a forgotten man in the UK, was regarded as a legend in Albania. When he died, there was a national day of mourning in Albania. Meanwhile, Mr. Bean is a fixture on airline entertainment channels. It's sold to more than 50 airlines and 200 countries. He's not particularly liked in Britain. But his 2008 film topped the box office in the Lebanon and the United Arab Emirates. In 2001, an Iranian court sentenced two members of a radical Islamic group to flogging for disrupting a performance of a show entitled Iran's Mr. Bean. Dr. Willibald Ruch, an Austrian professor of psychology, tested how laughter increases tolerance to pain by playing clips of Mr. Bean to his subjects. Did I say he was Austrian? It's worth recalling, given that I work in a university, though, that the reputations of Melville, Faulkner, Fitzgerald, and throw another writer into the mix, Nathaniel West, who sold virtually no books in his lifetime, were all redeemed by academics. That Miller's and Pinter's career might have stalled but for two individual critics who praised what others found baffling or unacceptable. There was a time, indeed, when the sale of Faulkner's books in this country depended entirely on universities. Every copy of Faulkner sold in the UK was sold to universities. But universities, especially American ones, can be fickle, subject to changing fashions, and this influences the choice and reputation of writers. The half-life of critical terms has surely become shorter and shorter, along with the movements to which they refer and the writers they favour and whose reputations they presumably enhance. Once it was the new criticism, then the new historicism, then cultural materialism and neo-Marxism, followed by deconstruction, postmodernism, post-postmodernism, post-feminism, post-colonialism, transnationalism, post-nationalism, post-Americanism, post-hegemonic, post-black, post-ethnicity, neo-cosmopolitan, neo-colonialism, globalism. Remember Marcus Aurelius again. No sooner is a thing brought to sight than it is swept by and another takes its place, and this too will be swept away. 20 years ago, I went to endless conferences on postmodernism, whose guru was Ihab Hassan, and one of whose central writers was Ray Federman. In 2007, Brian McHale published an article entitled, "What Was Postmodernism?" Today, you won't find Federman's books on Amazon. Hassan began writing fiction, and when I also did, sent me a note saying, "So you've realized it was all a game, too." Today, in American academia, the preferred texts are transnational, works which are expressive of membership of a sub-community, what the German academic Winfried Fluck describes as cultural radicalism, Chinese-American, Japanese-Americans, and so on. But as John Guillory has asked, what can we make of value judgments when value has already been ascribed to membership of a particular community? In his book, Cultural Capital, he's observed that the politics of canon formation has been understood as a politics of representation, the representation or lack of representation of certain groups, and that this means that the work is perceived to be immediately expressive of the author's experience as a representative of some social group. The reputation of some writers is thus in part a product of the shifting fashions of critical discourse, which of course in some degree reflects changes in the national conversation, as debates about a supposedly homogeneous identity, especially in America, fracture along lines of race, ethnicity, national origin, gender, sexual preference, and so on. Now, as John said, I'd like to add a word about Arthur Miller, not merely because this marks his centenary, hence the plethora of productions, but because he's an example of a man whose reputation dwindled in his own country and grew in others, particularly, though not exclusively, this one. The forces at play were politics and cultural change. For the last 30 years of his life, he was dismissed by American critics, though in truth, this has started much earlier. Both All My Sons and Death of a Salesman were banned from production in occupied areas of Europe on the grounds that they were anti-capitalist. Elements of the press continually referred to him as a communist playwright. The road version of Salesman was picketed by the American Legion, closed down. He regularly received bad reviews from magazines such as Commentary, Partisan Review, Commonweal, and The New Republic, often from former communists and now anti-communist leftists. The Crucible was widely attacked for suggesting there could be any parallel between witch hunting and the House Un-American Activities Committee on the grounds that witches didn't exist, but communists did. He was effectively declared un-American, sentenced to jail. His passport was removed, symbol of his national identity. The surprise is that the attacks would continue and become ever harsher in the decades after that. And all the critics I'm going to mention are major, major critics in America, some of them based in academe. For Robert Brustein, first of Yale and then of Harvard, after the fall, his 1964 play was a wretched piece of dramatic writing. An incident at Vichy the following year, an old dray horse about to be melted down for glue. He even suggested that Miller's popularity abroad was because his work improved in translation. Though quite how that explained British enthusiasm is beyond me. For Richard Gilman, another person who ended up in academe from journalism, A View from the Bridge was dismal. Martin Gottfried saw Miller as a slackening artist who had had his day. He then went on to write a biography of Miller. John Simon thought him the most overrated playwright. Stanley Kaufman found Death of a Salesman a flabby, occasionally false work. Going to a Miller play, he observed, was like going to the funeral of a man you wish you could have liked more. For David Denby in Commentary, Miller was a blockhead who would always be popular with assistant professors for whom the stupidities of his moral assertions will never go out of style. Delmore Schwartz spoke of the retarded conscience of Arthur Miller, the ball player for whom Marilyn Monroe consented to be circumcised, evidently confusing Miller with the baseball-playing Joe DiMaggio. For the Trotskyite Leslie Fiedler, who nearly gave the game away in an article in Encounter, incidentally, he was an overrated playwright whose dramas were as devious as his public life. And so it continued, until on his death, the Wall Street Journal obituary was headed, "Arthur Miller wasn't well-liked, and with good reason," while the New Criterions was headed, "Arthur Miller, commie stooge." In Britain, by contrast, as Nicholas Heitner remarked, all his plays are big events here. The National Theatre staged more productions of his plays than any other playwright with the exception of Shakespeare. On his 80th birthday, spent here, actually in Norwich, and not in the States, an Observer headline read, "The great playwright sticks in America's craw, but not ours." The marketplace ruled. Books were no longer subsidized, sales dropped. Those whose resistance to the regime had constituted a significant dimension of their reputation now found it increasingly difficult to find a readership. A year after Nelson Mandela's release, Ethel Fugard confessed he would have to find a new story and that the significance of theater might well diminish, since until then, it had played a subversive role. What now was to be subverted? Reputations are not only in the hands of authors or reviewers. Finally, let me ask a familiar question, so familiar I wouldn't ask it if we weren't talking about reputation. Is a literary reputation, or the reputation of a novel, a play, a critical work, immune to the personal reputation of the author? Does it matter that Strindberg was a profound misogynist, that Pirandello was a self-described fascist who gave his Nobel Prize medal to be melted down in support of the war against Abyssinia, that Céline was anti-Semitic, a fascist who advocated an alliance with Nazi Germany and was officially denounced as a national disgrace, that Günter Grass, as you know, confessed to serving with the Waffen-SS, and Christa Wolf that she had been an informer for the Stasi. She had, she said, forgotten she had been. In 1945, New Masses magazine asked, "Should Ezra Pound be shot?" Some writers thought he should be. A 30-year-old Arthur Miller thought not, but that he should not be released because, as Miller said, "I am a Jew, he was for burning Jews." Does it matter that Paul de Man wrote anti-Semitic articles for a collaborationist Belgian newspaper, was a thief, a liar, a forger, and a bigamist? In his first novel, Ghostwritten, David Mitchell has a character quote from Madame Bovary: "One should be wary of touching one's idols, for the guilt comes off on one's fingers."
Thank you very much.